Are there any lecture slides, copies of the slides outside? No, nobody's seen them. Oh, I had a, yeah, the previous lecture said everything makes funny noises. And so it does.
Does that?
I wonder what caused it to do so.
I may at some point have to turn this off, which will then be make for a different kind of video recording of it. Maybe if I'm really expressive, then it'll be okay for people watching the video, because even though there isn't sound, I'll be like pointing at things. Interesting that the information content are the different parts, actually. I've had a query from the secretary doing the course who says the assignment that you've already done, right, that's due in on Friday afternoon. Assignment you're doing this week is due on a Friday afternoon to the ITO. It's going to be marked by your tutors, who will then give it back to you with feedback in the week 11 tutorial. But that means that the course secretary has to route all of the hand-ins that go into the box to your tutors. And it would really, really, really help things, and also increase the chance that you will have your tutor spend more time on it, if you could write your tutor group and tutor name on the front page of your submission, please. I'll change the handout to say that, but just for people who are here, please write your tutor group and your tutor name, which is actually more important than writing your own name. Student number is good on the submission. This is not really working, is it? Anybody expertise on small microphones? Engineers? Okay. This seems to be doing something, but I don't know if it helps the recording or not. So this lecture and the next two lectures are about statistics, really. It's listed under unstructured data. This is not working. It's listed under unstructured data, but in practice, this is about statistical analysis of numeric or other data that's collected. And lots of it you can, in fact, apply to structured or semi-structured data. Ah, we have some slides. How did you produce those, Jan? Are they outside? You just found them on the street?
I just met the Kirsten Belko.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. So the Kirsten Belko has just turned up with those. Is the person who would really like you to write your tutor group on it. So in return for having the slides, please do. Okay. And for anybody who misses them, then these notes after the tutorial go up on on floor 5, turn right. There's a bookcase. So this is about statistics, really. It's listed on unstructured data, but that's kind of a loose connection. There's three lectures. Today, I'm going to talk about summary statistics, which most of you will be familiar with already. Next one is hypothesis testing, and also correlation coefficients, linear correlations, fitting a line to some points. And then chi-squared tests and significance in the third lecture, which is related to this collocation issue, or the examples given are how you can identify when two words form a correlation in data. And so we have particular examples that we'll be using for those, but they're very general statistical techniques. And depending on what you do in future years, you may need much more advanced techniques, but this is the kind of basic starting level. Some of you will already be familiar with this material. It's not in, as far as I can tell, it's not in the maths or informatics courses, but it may well be in maths courses you did at secondary school or earlier, or elsewhere. So lecture timetable, as I said last week, is slightly skewed because I have to be away at some research workshops this week and next week. So there's a lecture today, it's here. There's a lecture next Tuesday, and there's a lecture the Tuesday after that. But there are no lectures on the two Fridays. And in the corresponding weeks, the tutorial this week is on information retrieval, the tutorial next week will be on some statistical analysis, and the final tutorial in week 11, you'll get your assignment back, you get some feedback on it, you get a chance to ask questions about it and discuss what the content of the assignment. The assignment, you remember, is some questions from past papers. So they are past exam paper questions. You can also find other past papers on the informatics web pages, and also it's duplicated, actually. We have some on our web pages. There are also versions on the library's web pages. They're the same papers. And I'd recommend that you look at past exam questions, because as you'll see from year to year, the questions, I mean, the material is the same, the syllabus is the same, and many of the questions have a good indication of the level of question that will be involved, how much bookwork you need, how much applying that knowledge you need in questions, and so on. So there's no lectures on the two Fridays, lectures are on the Tuesdays. This leads to a situation which often happens at the end of courses, and I'm not very happy with, but the tutorial in week 10 on statistical analysis deals with material that is being covered in the final lectures. This is fairly inevitable if you have tutorials and lectures ending at roughly the same time, that the material right at the end of the course is really hard to usefully get into exercises and tutorials. And in this year, it's particularly poor, which is unfortunate. So I will put the coursework, the tutorial exercises for next week concern material that is being taught today and next week and, to some extent, the week after that. So I will put the lecture slides for next week and the week for all of the rest of the course online and make them recommended reading for the tutorial exercise. So we'll have, I know this has happened in other courses as well, happened with OP a bit earlier on. There will be a mismatch between what's happening in the tutorial and what's happening in the lectures. I'll make the lecture notes available in advance. You can read them. As it happens, these are also really, really standard topics that you can find in textbooks or online web tutorials. But be aware that at this point, the matching between lectures and tutorials is not going to be as good as I would like it to be. Sorry about that. I could do a quick check, though. The various things we're going to go over, some of you will have seen them before. For some of you, it'll be completely new. So starting at the easy end, how many people have know what a mathematical mean is, how you calculate the mean of a set of data? Excellent. Variance, standard deviation, linear regression, correlation coefficients, might have seen, Pearson correlation coefficients, Spearman rank test. I'm not going to do that one, actually. Chi-squared testing. Yeah, so if you've got science backgrounds, actually, you might do chi-squared testing for biological chemical samples. So those are the things, that's more than the things I'm going to cover. So if you've seen them, that's great. If you haven't, we'll be going over them in lectures. I'll provide the notes. And also, there are some people around here who have seen them. So all the people who are mug enough to put your hands up for everything, then they're the ones you should go and see if you've got a problem. And at least they can tell you where they learnt it. So as I say, these are standard things. I'll be going over it, but I'm not the only resource and source for these things. Okay, why do we analyse data? You analyse data to find structure and data. This is going to be the first three lectures I talked, the slides I had last time, so a little more briefly. We analyse data to find structure that's there or to confirm or refute a hypothesis. And next lecture we'll do a bit about what it means to confirm a hypothesis and how you know when you've done it. So statistics are an extremely powerful toolkit for doing this. And in the same way that an algorithm is effective when it does something better than the thing you first thought of. It's not just a way of doing things, it's a way that somebody's come up that is actually going to be more efficient or faster or can cope with more data than you were able to start with. Statistics are significant because they let you identify correlations and results and properties from data that you cannot see just by looking at it. And that's where they're powerful. Statistics that merely confirm exactly what you can already see in it are kind of interesting, but not that exciting. The real thing is when statistics can give you information to say, well, either the thing you thought was there is not there, or that some data where you can't see any real value in it, it can extract some information that isn't immediately visible. So statistics are really useful when they give you a confidence or information that you couldn't otherwise obtain. They're not simply to confirm your prejudices about existing data. The type of analysis depends on the data you've got and what you want to do with it, and there are different kinds of data. Qualitative typically means it's descriptive in some kind, and quantitative means you can associate numbers with it. But the degree of that can change, and there's this classification into four kinds of data scale. It's reasonably hard and fast, but you need to be aware that some kinds of data you might have be mainly in one scale, but you can give it a more or less numerical assignment than others. Categorical scale or nominal scales is where you're just putting things, classifying things by different types. So classifying visa applications by nationality, classifying students by where they live, their postcode for insurance purposes. Lots of things where you can divide data into different categories, maybe large ones, maybe narrow ones, but there's no implicit ordering, there's no numerical value attached to it. You might number the categories 1, 2, 3, but that's not numerically meaningful. And there's also no order on this. Postcodes, although they're kind of semi-numerical, or car license plates. If you took the first three digits of a car license plate, that's a number. Depending on which country it's relevant in, it might or might not carry some additional information, but the information is not numerical. It doesn't tell you anything about the size of the car. So those are nominal scales. And even with those, you can do some analysis on things. You can see how many things are in different categories and how not. But you can't do arithmetic on them, so. Oh, joy. This appears to be a lot. That machine seized up. Let's try another one. Ordinal scales are where you divide things into categories, but you can give them some ordering. You can say one is greater than another. You might not be able to say by how much. So the Beaufort wind scale, force scale is an example of this, which is actually does use numbers, where it classifies wind speeds on a scale from 0 to 12, and indeed the higher numbers relate to faster winds or more damage that's done. But it's not just because it's a numeric scale doesn't actually mean you can do arithmetic on it. It's not the case that one is twice as fast as the other, or that you can take the average between them. Similarly, exam result, exam grades, A, B, C, D, E. There's definitely an ordering to them. You can say that A is above B is above C is above D, or first class is above 2-1 is above 2-2 is above thirds. But there's no, you can't add and subtract. You can't reasonably take averages. In particular, the University of Edinburgh has a standard A, B, C, D, E scale for which mark ranges should be covered. And different grades cover different ranges of marks. And so actually, even though you might think A, B, C, you could take a mean of them, like the A's plus the B's plus the C's divided by something, that's not sensible. The only thing that's reasonable is the ordering. And there are lots of such situations where you can divide things into classes, you can maybe rank them, but you can't say anything meaningful about the distance one is above another. And so those are ordinal scales. If you have an ordinal scale, you have more information than you did with a categorical scale, and you can do some kinds of tests that you couldn't do with them. An interval scale is when you start having real numbers that actually mean something. But only to the extent that we can measure the relative value of something. So an interval scale is where you have some values, and they go up. You can have lower values here, higher values there. You can measure the distance between values. So these are given real numbered values. You can have P and Q, and you can say what's Q minus P, how much is Q above P. You can say Q is bigger than P. You can ask what the distance between Q and P is, but you can't double P or Q. An example here would be time. So you can give dates. It's sensible to ask how much time passed or how many seconds elapsed between this time and this time, but there's not an absolute sense of time, unless conceivably you're going to go back to the start of the universe. So in some contexts, time is an absolute scale, but mostly you just choose an arbitrary zero and then work from that. So time, the system time on a machine is typically measured in terms of nanoseconds since a particular point, but the point is definitely arbitrary. So some kinds of arithmetic are sensible. You can say what is 10 seconds after this time? What is the distance between these two times? But you can't add today and tomorrow and get a sensible result. So these are interval scales. They support subtraction. You can do averages of those in a way you couldn't do just with an ordinal scale. It's sensible to say what is the average of these values along the time scale and get something in here. But it's not sensible to add them all up. Ratio scale is a numerical scale where you have a zero, where you say it starts here. So if we're looking at temperature, for example, that does have a zero scale, though most of the time you'll be using it just as a ratio scale. Age, people's age, you can say this is twice as old as that, or something has been around for twice as long as that. The mass of something, the energy, the length of something, the size of an array in a computer system that is an absolute value. It starts at zero and it goes up. And with an ratio scale, you can add, you can subtract and take an average. You can also add them, you can multiply them by a real number. You can say this array is twice as long as that array, and that's meaningful to do. Yes, if you use the Big Bang as a zero point, then time is a ratio scale, but only in a context where really, really you're measuring behavior of the universe over its entire lifetime. Locally, it's much more like an interval scale. So we have these four kinds of scale. Categorical scale, just put things into different bins. Nominal, ordinal scale, you can rank them. You can say this is above that, but you don't necessarily know by how much or have a reliable measure for it. Interval scale, you can say this is this much further along than that. So that's like an ordinal scale, but with some numeric values attached to it. And then a ratio scale is where you've got all of the numeric, all of what you'd want to do with numbers. And so things that are like length and mass are ratio scales. And it's worth being aware of if you have a value, number of students in a class, That'll be a ratio scale. You know what zero is, it can give a numeric value. Lots of things will fall into that. What's slightly clever is that you can have things that do not fall into this, that you only have ordinal information, that more people were attended this class than that class, but actually you don't really know the numbers, you just know it was in a larger lecture theatre and it seemed reasonably full. But you can still get statistical data out of that, even if you have these weaker scales like ordinal categorical. Do you remember back at the start of the semester, we had you filled out a survey form so we could get some data to analyze, which we'll do in later tutorials. And there was nationality. There was UK, EU, overseas. Now, that's a categorical scale. You can classify people into three kinds. But there is absolutely no numerical information to attach to that. There's no way to order those or to say this is, the EU is this far away and overseas is that far away. It's not meaningful. But you can still extract sensible statistics from those things. Okay, so supposing you have some kind of data and some kind of scale, it's often useful to visualize data. So we had last time the notion that with document comparison, one was working in an n-dimensional space and there were ideas of clustering. That's one kind of visualization where maybe you can't draw it, but you can pose your questions and your algorithms in terms of this visualization. Also, if you're working in lower dimensions, you can actually draw a chart or plot a graph or something. And that can help you look at it and say, well, I think it behaves like this. That means you might then pose a hypothesis which you can then test, or you can get an idea of properties of the data. But it doesn't immediately tell you whether the things that you guessed are true or not. It really is a way to get you to pose questions. A histogram or a bar chart, if you've got categorical data, then you can draw a bar chart. So even if you don't have any numerical information, you can draw them. So supposing we had those three categories, UK, EU, but not UK, and overseas students, we can draw a bar chart, we can say numbers. It's crucial when you're drawing this not to put some space in here, not to say, if you draw them all together, then that's an indication that the area underneath is significant, which it isn't particularly. These do not abut, you can put them in any order. And you shouldn't draw a line through it like that, because that has no numerical meaning at all. These are just three categories. If you have an interval or ratio scale, then you can make this a numerical setting, and you can draw a line, you can draw a continuous curve with the area under it, and so on. It's worth being aware of these distinctions between the kinds. I'm going to brush that off because this is so evil. So that's if you had a categorical scale, you can draw some bar charts. If you have a numerical scale, supposing this is age, and the number of students at an age, we can then draw them closer together, or we can even, if we get a very precise age data, we could draw a whole series of points throughout. We could get a curve, because that is a numerical scale, and it's a ratio scale. Okay, so if you have a graph of something being distributed, so this is something that we're sampling, and it is on a ratio scale, so we're looking at, say, scores in grades and in an exam, marks in an exam, not grades, marks in an exam, then you might get something like this. And typically, in any situation where things are being randomly generated, we'll end up with a normal distribution. And there are general results about why this is the case. So lots of situations, if you don't know anything more about what the source of the data is, you can assume a normal distribution, and often you'll observe it as well. And it looks like this. Who has met the normal distribution before? We've seen it somewhere. Okay. The important key thing about the normal distribution is that if nothing else is affecting things, this is what will come out. Two crucial values associated with the normal distribution. The mean, usually written mu. In this case, the mean is zero. And the standard deviation. So standard deviation is a measure of how widely some distribution is spread. And it's not working. It turns out that the standard deviation in a normal distribution, not in every distribution, is just where the curve has a point of inflection. It starts going from down to round. So it's not the whole span of the distribution, but it's a measure of how wide the distribution span is. The general equation for normal distribution is this e to the x minus mu squared over 2 sigma squared. You don't need to know that. The point is it is known. And often with data, if you don't know anything more about it, one might assume an abnormal distribution, and that is reasonable to do so. But it doesn't mean that it actually is a normal distribution. It just can be that given your state of ignorance about some particular system, then a normal distribution is all you, the best you can guess. But often in scientific experiments or in well, some informatics ones as well, you'll see some people assume a normal distribution. And this is not because they have any deep knowledge that it is a normal distribution. Sometimes they will, sometimes they won't. It's that if you don't know anything, then that is a reasonable assumption to make. But it's very easy to think, oh, it's this because I know it is. Statistics. So statistics is the study of some numbers. But strictly speaking, a statistic is a value that captures some property of the data. Not the whole of the data, but it measures some property of the data. So there is a notion of a single statistic. And usually it's numerical. It doesn't absolutely have to be. So the mean of a normal distribution is a statistic that tells you where the normal distribution is. Is it centered around this point? Is it centered around some other point? Standard deviation is as well. And you can also do this with data that's not normally distributed and compute them. There's also other ones that I'll talk about in a moment, the mode and the median, which are ways of capturing what is the center point of some data. So a statistic is any numerical value that captures some property of some collection of data. Summary statistics are ones that try and capture an overall property of the whole set of data. So a statistic just means some piece of data. A summary statistic is something that's trying to capture all of properties of the whole set of data. And statistics inevitably mean throwing information away about something. And you shouldn't feel bad about that. You should just be aware of it. Remember we had with the data retrieval that the vector space model, you just count the number of occurrences of words in a document. And that might have, that's throwing away an enormous amount of information about the document. But it can be useful for carrying out certain tasks. And it's this being used to the fact that a statistic will not capture all the information in the data set. And you can imagine situations where it might lead you seriously astray if things are skew in ways that you didn't anticipate. But nonetheless, most of the time it can be useful and it can be a reasonable way to focus on the task that you need to get done, even if you are losing some information along the way. So summary statistics are ones that will summarize the property of a whole set of data in a single value. So this is an enormous amount of data is being thrown away. But if the data you get is the thing that you're interested in, that's worth doing. So some sample summary statistics. Supposing you have a bunch of data values, x1, x2, all the way up to xn. The mode is the value that occurs most often. And this you can do with any kind of data. You can even do it with categorical data where you've just got different bins to put things in. You know nothing else, but you know one of them is more full. If we do postcodes for all of you where you're living in Edinburgh, then we might find some postcode turns up more often than any others. That would be the mode. It means that there's more of you living there than anywhere else. It doesn't mean there aren't people living in other places. It doesn't mean that most of you live in that place. It just means it's the most common one. You might find that some data value occurs that more than one data value occurs most often. In that case, data just has more than one mode. So here's a data set of some numbers, and the number 6 appears 3 times, which is more than any others. So there it's applied to numbers, but it absolutely can apply to any kind of data at all. It could be ordinal, it could be categorical. You just look for the one that occurs most often. If you have numbers, it's possibly not the most useful one. But if you have an ordinal scale, if we're looking at degree qualifications, people come out with a first, 2-1, 2-2, and a third, or you're looking at grades in an exam, or you're looking at postcodes or nationalities or something like that, then the mode is a sensible statistic to look at because you don't have that much else to work with. There's a situation that, okay, works for all kinds of data scale. You can use it on numerical scales, but it's less useful because probably you have more information to go on. If you actually know people's marks, then you're not that interested in what's the most common mark in an exam. You're interested in maybe what the most common grade or what the highest mark, something like that. So the mode, as you get more and more precise data, the mode becomes less and less relevant. To the point that if you have real valued data, so real numbers, not just integers, then the mode is almost entirely useless because it's very unlikely that the same value will occur more than once. This is a general property. If you have, so we had the sense in which as you get more and more information about something, you get more and more numerical detail. So you have lots of categories, that's kind of useful, but if we could put the categories in order, we have more information about a system. If we can put them on to give them numbers, integers, then that's more information. But at some point you start to lose it. If you get real value data, supposing we're measuring people's heights, For a start, there's a question of precision. How accurately can you measure somebody's height? Or you're measuring times between arrivals of a particle at some particles at a particle detector. So you're measuring an interval of time. Then you've got a real number. You'll record it to some degree of precision. And then, actually, you've lost some information because you don't know exactly what it is. And you can add them and subtract them, but you can't compare them. You can't compare them for equality. Real numbers, we can safely see if one is larger than another. And we can add them, multiply them, divide them, and so forth. But you shouldn't attempt to compare real numbers. So if you have an integer scale, it's reasonable to do arithmetic on it and to compare them. If you have a real number scale where values can take absolutely anything along the real line, then it's not reasonable to do comparisons. Despite the fact that the programming language you're writing in may well allow you to try and do this. Lots of programming languages will let you try and compare real floating point numbers one with another. And this is a bad thing to do, because if it ever gives the value true, it's almost certainly fibbing. So there's an example of this, if I can get this to work. So Python is the easiest language to hand for this. If I take, let's see this right, 1 plus 0.2, any guesses as to what the answer is going to be? This will work, guys. It's 1.2, right? This is not altogether surprising. If I ask whether 1 plus 0.2 equals 1.2, it will say it's true. If I ask whether 1.2 minus 0.2, well, what's that? It's 1. 1.2 minus 0.2, is that equal to 1? Sorry. Is that equal to 1? It is. 0.2 plus 1. 1.2. 1.2 minus 1. This is a surprising one. We've got lots of arithmetic happening there, but one of those results is not what you'd expect. If I take 1 away from 1.2, I do not get the answer 0.2. I get something quite close to 0.2, but not exactly the same. And the strange thing is, you could probably do better than that in your head. You could probably successfully subtract 1 from 1.2 and get 0.2. And yet, strangely, the machine can't. Offhand, anyone know why it's getting this wrong? I mean, it's not getting it very wrong, right? This is really, 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 really close to 0.2. And that's part of the problem. The thing I did wrong was to attempt to do the equality test there between 1.2 minus 1.0 and 0.2. Because actually, this number and 0.2 are, for all practical purposes, exactly the same. If you were given any physical quantity, any physical item, which had a dimension or a property that was 0.19999 rather than 0.2, you would be unable to distinguish them. But somehow, because it's not written out like that, you say, oh, it's very different. It's long. It's got lots of nines. Those really are almost exactly the same. You just shouldn't try and compare them with quality, because the kind of rounding errors and the errors implicit in everything that you do with measurement will mean that you may sometimes get the result you don't expect. The reason why it's doing this is because, although for our convenience it's printing things and reading things in base 10, the machine is working in binary, and that applies not just to integers but also to fractions. So it's working in binary fractions. So it will represent 0.2 as it turns out that as a binary fraction, I'm supposed to memorize this, I can't remember what it is. We get a recurring decimal, a recurring fraction like that. 0.2 is a fixed length decimal in base 10, fraction in base 10. It's a recurring infinite fraction in binary, which means that we can't have an exact representation on the machine. What happens is you typically chop it off to some number of bits. It might be 64, it might be 128, it might be 32. And that means that there is rounding involved when adding or subtracting them. It's like 0.3 recurring in decimal. There's rounding involved, and most of the time the rounding will cover this up, but not all of the time. And in this case, it turns out that, so 1.2 is represented as one kind of binary infinitesimal. 1 is not, that's a finite one. And some ways around, the rounding works the way you expect, and some ways around, it doesn't. And there are reasons for this. I mean, it's not the case that this is stupid. This is following completely standard rounding things. This is the kind of error that turns up all the time in floating point. You just have to be aware of it. It's just that this makes it particularly visible. So this is a fun thing to try out in your favorite programming language. Can it do subtraction of 1 from 1.2? And does it get 0.2 or not? So do not even attempt to compare real numbers. It's just a bad idea. Programming language should really not let you try. Okay, median. We have a bunch of statistics now. They do have to be numbers. They have to be ordinals. They have to be able to order them. You write them in non-decreasing order. Non-decreasing means that you might have two the same, but they just mustn't go down. And the median is the value in the middle. You write out all the values you've got, choose the one in the middle, that's the median. If you've got an even number of values, then you have two in the middle, and it's tricky what to do. Best is probably return both of them, actually. If you have to choose one, if they're numbers, you could take the average. If they're not, then you might mention them both. Depends. So here, this data, again, is numerical data, so we can order it, and the value in the middle is 5. But you can do that for any kind of ordinal data. You could do it for exam grades, A, B, C, D, E. Take everybody's grade in the class, write them down A, B, C, D, E, and write all the A's, then all the B's, then all the C's, then the D's, and then look for the median value, the one in the middle, and that will be meaningful. So you can do mode on categorical data. Median, you need ordinal data, but you do not need numbers. And if you just have categorical data, though, if we have your countries of origin, there's no sense of a median in that. There's still an issue with what machines will let you do. If you've got a database with values stored in it, and you have something that's stored, categorical data that's stored as a string, so say the country in which a city lies, you've got a database of cities and the countries that they're in, that's categorical data, name of the country. But the database will probably let you sort them and order them because it's a string. And strings can be given a lexicographic order depending on where they'd appear in the dictionary. So a database will let you treat the names of countries as if they were ordinal data, and it'll probably let you find the median. But you shouldn't do so. Even if the data representation supports it, if you know the underlying data falls into one category or another, or one kind of data scale, then you should respect that. Okay, the one that everybody really knows about is the mean. If you have a set of data, the mean, usually written mu, so that's the mean of the data itself, is the sum of all the data values divided by the total number of values. And although it involves addition, which you can't generally do on interval scales, because you then divide by the total number again, it's a weighted average, then it makes sense. So mean is sensible even if you don't have a zero. You can take the mean of a number of moments in time, get one in the middle, even if the zero chosen is arbitrary. But it also, of course, works for ratio scales where you do have a zero. Categorical data doesn't make sense to take an average of city names, and it doesn't make sense for ordinal data either. If you have a bunch of grades, A, B, C, D, E, it doesn't make sense to take a mean, even if the ordinal data are given numbers. So if you rank everybody in the class, all the marks in an exam, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, the highest scoring down to the lowest scoring, and you give them a number, that's still a number. You could attempt to take the mean of it, but it will be a bad thing to do. Ordinal data, categorical and ordinal data, you shouldn't take a mean, even if it would let you try. So if you had if postcodes were numerical, you shouldn't try and take the mean of postcodes. The variance. Variance and standard deviation are measures of how widely data is spread around its mean. And what you do is take this xi minus mu means data point I, subtract its distance from the mean. And then you square it and add them and divide by the number. The squaring is because some things will be above the mean, some will be below, so you'll have positive and negative differences. If you just took the average of the differences, then you'd get zero. We could take the absolute value, we could turn minus values into plus values and take the average of those, and that gives a perfectly good statistic, but it's hard to compute with. So what we do is you take a square and use that. So this is just for ease of computation. The mean absolute deviation would be legitimate to take, it's just not as mathematically convenient. So you square them, which makes them positive, take the mean of that. And you get the variance. The variance measures the square of the data. Yeah, what have we got wrong? How is taking that? It's not harder to calculate, it's harder then to subsequently do things with. It's that if you want to say, for a particular distribution, if it really is a normal distribution, what would the mean be? And that's harder to calculate. if you wanted to say, what will happen to my data if I double all the values? Well, that one actually is probably okay. But if you had some, if you wanted to show some properties of standard deviation, you wanted to say, for samples drawn from a particular distribution, how much should I expect the standard deviation to change as different people draw different samples? That's harder to calculate. So yeah, actually calculating squares is moderately costly, and calculating absolute values would be easier. It's more, what could you do with it? Yeah, so having squares is a pain because you get multiplication and you get square roots, which are hard things to calculate. It means that it's mathematically better behaved. As far as students are concerned, this is worse. So the variance involves a square. So the variance is typically the square of the scale of the range over which data is values are ranging. And it's sometimes convenient to take the square root of that, which is called the standard deviation. This is the thing that went up to the inflection point in the normal distribution. So standard deviation has about the same scale as the actual deviation of values around the mean. And you can do this for interval and ratio data, but not ordinal categorical. So here are two calculated examples of mean and standard deviation. So for this 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 data, the mean is 4. Remember, the mode was 6, and the median was 5, but actually the mean is slightly below that. This data is somewhat skewed. The variance is 5, and the standard deviation is just over 2, which means that that's the amount. The mean is 4, and then the data goes between minus 2 and plus 2, or rather most of it lies between plus or minus 2 around 4, and obviously there are outliers in this case, quite a lot of 6s and a 7. So those are the statistics, many of which you've probably met before, mean and standard deviation, mode, and median. They give you, each of those gives you a statistic, some fact about a set of data, and they give you a fact about about all of the data. And that's so-called population statistics, where you've got, say, all of the students in the class and you know all of their grades. You have the census data, which is coming up soon, will consist of complete data about a population. But in lots and lots of situations, you don't have all the data. You want a statistic about some population of things, but you don't even have all of the values of which you want to take the statistic. All you have is a sample. So you want to know the average earnings of graduates from the university. You may have complete data on that, but probably you don't. Probably only some of them have filled out that irritating form that you had to do when you graduated, or only some of them are in contact with you, or only some of them would answer the phone when you try and ring them up and find out information about them. So you have a sample. For scientific data, this is almost always the case. You want to know what proportion of mice will grow better when fed that. You can't test it on all mice. You're not going to. All you have is a sample from a population. And you may know the size of the whole population, you might not. And so that's two steps removed. You want to take a statistic, which is a piece of information about a whole set of data, but you don't even have the whole set of data. You just want to make some estimate of that statistic. So we have the idea of the statistic, and then an estimator for the statistic. So here's an example. Surveys, marketing surveys, opinion polls. Software design, looking at requirements of users, or equally measuring the performance of a piece of software. If you want to say, this system should always return web pages within a tenth of a second, or the following, checking out a book through a library should always happen in under 2 seconds. Actually, the always can be quite hard to do, but you can take a sample, you can do it a number of times and see what it comes out. And it may be that even though all of the values you sample turn out to be under 2 seconds or whatever, by the variation in it, and the fact they're really nearly up to 2 seconds, you could decide that you are not confident enough that it will do it every time. So from an observation, you may make deductions about the whole system. So in these cases, you're not going to get exhaustive data, so you want an estimate. You get a sample, which allows you to estimate the statistic for the whole thing. So you're not directly interested in the statistic on the sample, you're using it in order to estimate the statistic on the whole population. Now, even being able to do that depends on having chosen a sensible sample. You want a sample to be chosen randomly from the population. What randomly means is philosophically challenging, actually. And there are certain ways to try and do it. It's good to have a large sample. Just choosing one person, one graduate, to try and estimate graduate salaries is probably not a good way to get a reliable estimate of the overall. But sometimes you can't get that many. Sometimes you may not be able to analyze the data from a very large sample size. This is an issue. So the UK Census, the current difficulty is trying to get enough people to answer it. And by and large, it's, in that case, it's not worth the effort of the larger sample to for the improvement in the statistics. If you want to know the average population, the average earnings in the UK, or how often people go shopping and so forth, then actually it's the effort reward trade-off is such that it's better to ask a smaller number of people and analyze the data really thoroughly than it is to try and actually ask everybody, because then you have no energy left to analyze the data and you don't get much better data for it. Randomness is really hard, but what you want to do is get a sample that's representative of a population. This is a bit like when we were building, had the information about building corpora. You want a balanced sample and then randomly choose it so it is representative of the language it's taken from. And in statistics, it is important to try and quantify the relationship between the statistics in the sample and the statistics in the population, and what you have to do in terms of randomness and size of sample in order to get reliable statistics about the whole population. We'll just look at how you can compute an estimate of the statistic for the population, but not how reliable is that estimate going to be, though that's one of the more reliable things there is. There's a... So in 95, about 15 years ago, more than that, there was an election in the UK in which the people who did the polling actually asked people which party would you support if there was an election tomorrow, who would you vote for. Pollsters came up with a certain opinion and said one party would win. On polling day, so they said Labour would win. On polling day, Labour lost dramatically. The Conservatives did very well. There was much more right-wing voting than the pollsters had expected. And one of the effects there is that actually people wouldn't own up to certain kinds of vote, or perhaps people were more confident about, more open about saying they'd vote one way than admitting they would vote the other. But one of the best defences I ever saw of how the pollsters had got their results so catastrophically wrong compared to the actual voting was that was the argument to say, well, actually sampling people was a much better way to find out their opinion than trying to make them turn up in a voting booth and fill out the form. That the actual vote was a really poor measure of people's opinion, and the statisticians would be a much better way of electing the government. So it's great. You're not wrong. It's the voting system can't count properly. My statistics are better. And astonishingly, that there's some truth in that, that the best way to find information is to take a random sample and ask that than to try and coerce people into a comprehensive sample. So final thing is this about estimated statistics. So we have this, you have to really be aware of this difference between a statistic on a particular set and the statistic you're trying to get in order to estimate the statistic on the wider population. So you have a sample, little n, x1 to xn, from a big population, big N. That less than means that n is little n is a lot less than big N. That's usually the situation. And you're going to use the sample to estimate statistical values for the whole population. The thing that's really surprising is that if you have a suitably random chosen sample, then a very small sample can tell you a very large amount, a very large population, which is perhaps unexpected. And sometimes the calculation is what you expect, and sometimes it isn't. We'll see situations where it's very slightly different to what you expect. The mean, it's straightforward, though. If you take the mean of a sample, that is a really good estimate for the mean of the whole population. It's generally a little m rather than a mu, because you're saying that's your estimate of the population mean. It's not. It happens to be the same as a sample mean, but that's just because means are not really well behaved. So if you take a sample, and it's numerical data for which you can take a mean, so it's ratio or interval scale, and you take the mean of your sample, that gives you, it's called an unbiased estimator for the whole population. It might be wrong, you might in fact have a really poor choice of sample, but over time, if you do this in several kinds of sample on several different situations, on average, it would tell you the mean of the population. Variance, it's not quite the same situation. To estimate the variance of the population, well, remember, variance is the average of the squares of the distance from the mean. But we don't know the mean of the population. We only know the mean of a sample. So we have to use our estimate, m. So you take the variance of, you take the distance from the estimated mean, and then you divide it by n minus 1. So if we're doing it the variance of the sample, we divide by n. If we want to estimate the variance of the population, we use n minus 1. And this is true for various reasons to do with the fact that we're using the sample mean as the estimate, not the real mean, and so forth. So what's happened is there are so-called degrees of freedom involved here, and we're using the data twice because the xi's contribute both in the variance where they appear explicitly and to that estimator we had for the mean, the m. And because each of the xi's is contributing more than once, we have lost what's called a degree of freedom, and so we divide by n minus 1 instead. So if you have, and this is not the same as the variance of the sample, it's slightly larger. So if you have a small sample taken from a large population, and you want to estimate its the mean of the population, you just take the mean of the sample. You're guessing that the sample spreads around in much that spreads around the central value much the same way as the population does. But if you want to measure the spread of the population, its standard deviation, you take a slightly different formula. The estimate of the spread of the population is slightly wider than the observed spread of the sample. And the reason is that if the sample cluster kind of, if your estimate of the mean was wrong, if your sample happened to be drawn from the bottom half of the distribution, then it would look quite compact, even though in fact they're all way off the real mean. So you'd lose some information. So you have to bump it up and actually say the estimate of the standard deviation of the population, which is written S rather than sigma, is slightly different to the sample population. So in this, for variance, this is not a big difference, actually, especially if your sample is very small, then n minus 1 and n are quite different. But if you have a large sample, it doesn't make a big difference. It's just an indicator of a phenomenon that happens with more refined statistics, where, in fact, you have to bear in mind the difference between look at the statistic on the sample and trying to use it to estimate the statistic on the whole population. So there's this warning that actually, almost always, this is the one you really need, but you need to be aware that there are two of them. And sometimes you might have complete data and you want to take the variation, in which case you use them divided by n. And typically, if you have a calculator, it may have two buttons. You'll have something for calculating the standard deviation, and it will come in two forms. It might put a squiggle on one. It might put n, n minus 1 underneath them. But there'll be some indicator. If you're in any context where a machine is offering to calculate for you the standard deviation, then with luck, it'll offer you two almost imperceptibly different choices. And what it'll be doing there is saying, do you want the standard deviation of the thing you've got or the thing from which you believe that it's been drawn? Right, so that was really, really, really tiny amount on statistics, not even so much on the calculation, mostly on why you need to calculate and what it means. There are lots and lots of books on statistics. They get into it in much more detail than I will, and they present from lots of different angles. So these are two fairly straightforward, gentle introductions, mostly aimed at social science students. So people over in humanities, particularly social science, do a lot of statistical analysis, and they do some very fancy statistical analysis, often because the data they've got is a bit shaky, so you have to work hard to get meaningful statistics out of it. And so they have they're doing it because they need to, not because they have a love of stats and mathematics. So often they have much more workman-like introductions. If you want to read a stats book by mathematicians or by statisticians who are slightly different people, then this is much harder because that's doing it just for the love of it. If you really like them, that's the thing to do, but it won't be for everybody. And then these are two books about statistics and the use of statistics. Catalyzed Statistics is half a century old, but it's still fantastically relevant, and lots of the things it talks about are absolutely real. A more recent one, The Tiger That Isn't, by Glasslund and Dillnut. This is a book by two journalists who write a series of columns about people's use and abuse of statistics, and also the interaction between human reactions to data and anecdotes